Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 109, The Great Fire of New York and Nathan Hale. By September 1776, the Continental Army held on to Harlem Heights at the northern tip of Manhattan and Fort Washington along the Hudson River. The British controlled the remainder of the island. General Lord Percy, who you may remember from his dramatic rescue of the British Army at Lexington, commanded a force posted just north of the city on the east side of the island. General Cornwallis, who had sailed to America only to fail miserably under General Clinton at Fort Sullivan in South Carolina, still served under General Clinton. After his success at the Battle of Long Island, Howe posted both generals with the command of the front lines just south of Harlem Heights, but with strict instructions to stay put and not advance on the enemy. General Howe settled himself into a comfortable estate at Mount Pleasant, north of Kips Bay, but still well back from the front lines. There he wrote dispatches to Lord Germain and others in London about the successful campaign to capture New York. Once again following his victory, Howe would pause for several weeks, giving the enemy time to regroup and plan their next steps. On September 19, 1776, General Howe issued another decree to the public, urging the American people to return to their old allegiance to the king and bring all this violence to an end. The proclamation got relatively little attention, since only a few loyalist newspapers in New York and New Jersey published it. Some Americans in the region who were now under direct occupation of the British Army swore allegiance, but mostly because any patriots living in those areas had already fled. The Howes somehow seemed convinced that they could get the patriots to lay down their arms without a long and terrible bloodletting. But, as we all know, that was not going to be the case. The proclamation, much like others before it and after it, went largely ignored. Now, this is not to say that no one flocked to the Tory cause. With Greater New York City area now firmly under the British Army control, local Tories began to recruit locals to join Tory militia units to assist the British in retaking the colonies for the king. Militia General Oliver Delancey raised a brigade of about 1,500 men on Long Island. Major Robert Rogers raised the Provincial Corps of Tories known as Rogers Rangers, resurrecting a name that he had used during the French and Indian War. While much quieter now, though, some local New Yorkers remained loyal to the Patriot cause and were willing to cause trouble for the occupying army. Just after midnight on September 21, 1776, alarm began to spread through New York that the city was on fire. There were no alarm bells since the Continentals had taken all the bells before leaving the city. Word spread by shouts that much of the city was engulfed in flames. Civilians and soldiers worked through the night to control the fire and extinguish the flames. They tore down several houses as fire breaks to keep the fire from spreading and formed bucket brigades to bring water to the burning buildings. Actually, most of the military men working to extinguish the fire were Marines from the Navy. Some soldiers may have acted independently, but General Howe did not deploy any soldiers until the following day. Instead, Howe kept his soldiers on alert all night, just in case the fire was an attempt to distract him as part of a daring night invasion. That, of course, never happened. Some thought the arson attacks specifically targeted the Church of England. Much of the area burned was the area around Trinity Church, including the church itself. The area was mostly residences, as well as the holy ground area, where prostitution and nightlife was most active. The commercial areas and dockyards mostly survived intact, though many had already fled the city before the British Army arrived. The Army's arrival had created a major housing shortage. The loss of so many buildings left many families homeless with nowhere to go. No one seems certain how the fire actually started. Of course, rumors shot around, probably correctly, that this was the work of Patriot saboteurs. The fire seems to have started in several places at once and spread very rapidly, thanks to a strong wind blowing north. General Howe's reports indicate that several arsonists were caught and killed on the spot, but gives little detail. Other accounts give gruesome stories of arsonists being pinned to walls with bayonets, hanged from lampposts. One report even says that a soldier caught an arsonist in the act, picked him up, and threw him into the burning building that he had just set on fire and burned him alive. Some patriots accused the occupying army, mostly the Hessians, of starting the fire in order to cover their looting of the city. There were some accusations of soldiers looting burning buildings, but the notion that the British or Hessians started the fire seems to be propaganda with no factual basis. Whatever the accuracy of any of these stories, it's clear that the British believed the fire was a deliberate act of sabotage to deny them use of the city. The fire ended up burning about 1,000 buildings, more than a fourth of the city. Only a shift in winds prevented it from destroying much more. There's no evidence that Washington had anything to do with the fire. Congress had instructed him not to destroy the city, and Washington was not the type of man to defy Congress, even when he thought privately that its decisions were foolish. The majority of Congress seemed to think that patriots would retake the city and that it would be a waste to destroy it. Washington wrote to Congress the following day to report the fire, which he described as an accident. Again, it would be highly out of character for Washington to lie in a report to Congress. However, in his private correspondence, Washington did make clear that he certainly wasn't sorry about the fire. He wrote his cousin that if he had been allowed to use his own judgment, he would have burned the city to the ground before leaving it. He also commended, quote, "Providence or some good honest fellow has done more for us than we were disposed to do for ourselves," end quote, by starting the fire. Following the fire, the British increased vigilance to prevent any further cases of arson. Howe decided to keep the city under martial law rather than returning Governor Tryon and Mayor David Matthews to power. Instead of returning the king's peace to the city, it remained an armed camp under military control. The British Army also went to great efforts to find the culprits responsible for setting the fire. They rounded up and questioned over 200 suspects. One reason to question the rumors of unnamed saboteurs being killed during the fire is that no one was caught in the act and arrested. If several people were captured, one would think that not all of them would be killed and that some would have been arrested. The 200 suspects were arrested in the following days and all faced questioning and were eventually released. The British never found enough evidence to bring anyone to trial. One unlucky victim of the fire, though, was Continental Army Captain Nathan Hale. A few weeks earlier, before the British had even invaded Manhattan, Washington had asked for volunteers to cross over to Long Island and gather intelligence on the enemy. Captain Hale volunteered for the mission. As a former schoolteacher from Connecticut, he decided his best cover would be to play a schoolteacher from Connecticut looking for work before the beginning of the school year somewhere on Long Island. He had to go back to Connecticut and take a boat across to the northeastern part of Long Island on September 12th, about 3 days before the British landed at Kipps Bay. Hale made his way across Long Island down toward New York City, paying attention to the enemy's troop deployments and numbers. He took detailed notes and drew sketches to record what he found. Sadly for Captain Hale, he had missed some critically important spying 101 classes. He wrote down lots of notes, but did not bother to use any sort of code or invisible ink, both in common use by other spies during this period. He did not have any local contacts or safe houses along the way, nor anyone local that he could trust. He also had no way to get the information back to the American lines unless he returned with the information himself. We don't know exactly what information Hale discovered because he never returned any reports to the Americans. He wandered across Long Island while the British crossed the East River at Kipps Bay, captured the city, and set up defenses against the Americans at Harlem Heights. Somehow, though, Hale made his way across the river into New York City. He was there on September 21st when the fire swept across the island. The morning after the fire, he made his way north toward the front lines. As Hale waited on the coast, the British ship Halifax came ashore. Hale apparently approached the landing party, thinking they might be Americans. Aware of the fire and seeing Hale was nervous, the British crew arrested him, thinking he might be one of the arsonists. They found his notes and sketches in his clothing and took him to General Howe as a suspected spy. Under questioning, Hale admitted being a Continental officer. Since he was caught behind enemy lines and out of uniform, Howe could treat him as a spy rather than a prisoner of war. He could be hanged immediately and without trial. Although there does not appear to be any reason to believe that Hale was involved in the New York fire, Howe was in no mood to offer clemency. Although not required, accused spies normally would at least receive a court-martial. Having spent the whole night prior dealing with the fire and hunting for suspected arsonists, Howe ordered Hale hanged as a spy without trial. Howe turned over Hale to the provost marshal, William Cunningham, a Tory who had fled Boston a year earlier and who had been a victim of Patriot mob attacks in New York before the British arrived. Cunningham was in no mood to show any kindness or sympathy to any rebel who fell into his hands. He scheduled the hanging for the following morning. He also denied Hale his last requests, having a clergyman present or access to a Bible. The next morning, during a delay as they prepared the gallows, the chief engineer, John Montresor, took Hale into his tent and had a short conversation. He also provided Hale with paper and ink so that he could write two final letters, one to his brother and the other to his commanding officer. Once the gallows were ready, guards led Hale to his execution. Montresor recorded Hale's famous last words, "I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country." The phrase came from a popular play of the day, Cato, by Joseph Addison. It was about a Roman politician who committed suicide rather than living under a tyrannical emperor. Another officer, named Mackenzie, also present at the execution, noted that Hale showed bravery and commented that it was the duty of every soldier to obey the orders of his commander, but did not record Hale's supposed famous last words. His failure to note them has led to some debate as to whether Hale actually uttered that phrase for which he is remembered. On September 22, 1776, at around 11 a.m., the British hanged Captain Hale and buried his body. Montresor turned over the two letters he had written to the provost, who promptly destroyed them. Later that evening, Montresor went over to the American lines at Harlem Heights under a flag of truce to discuss a prisoner exchange. While there, he revealed to the Americans that the British had hanged Hale as a spy that morning and passed along his famous last words. Word of Hale's last words circulated among the army, but Washington did not choose to publicize the matter at the time. Washington may have been embarrassed at the great risk and lack of support to which he subjected Hale. He may also have been concerned about the publicizing of his use of spies at all. Washington was already preparing to send other spies, though with greater protection and training. Reports of Hale's famous last words did not appear in newspapers until months later. Now, the same day that the British hanged Hale, the Continental Army prepared an execution of its own, Ebenezer Leffingwell. During the Battle of Harlem Heights, Colonel Joseph Reed encountered Leffingwell headed away from the front lines. Reed thought Leffingwell was deserting and confronted him. Now, I've mentioned Joseph Reed in passing a few times, but he is important in several future events, so it might be worth a little more background now. Colonel Reed was a Philadelphia lawyer who had accompanied Washington from Philadelphia back to Cambridge in 1775, when Washington first took up command of the Continental Army. Reed had not intended to follow Washington all the way, but he got swept up in the moment and found himself in Cambridge with the army. He provided some clerical assistance to the new commander, but then insisted that he needed to return home and resume his legal practice. Washington begged him to return and claimed he could not function without him. Reed became Washington's first adjutant and remained close to the commander. Washington was always a very closed and private man, but did seem to open up to a very small number of trusted associates. Reed apparently became one of those trusted confidants during the war, and while we'll see later Reed would lose that confidence and trust, at this time the two remained very close, and Reed carried the confidence of Washington and his authority in matters of command. So, on September 16th, Colonel Reed was on his horse, delivering orders for Washington during the battle, when he encountered Leffingwell. According to Reed, Leffingwell was clearly afraid and running away from battle. Reed ordered Leffingwell to return to the front lines, but soon found him doubling back and running in the other direction. Reed rode after the soldier and confronted him once again. At that time, Leffingwell pointed a gun at Reed and pulled the trigger. The gun either misfired or wasn't loaded. Reed then attempted to shoot Leffingwell on the spot, but could not fire his gun either. He slashed at Leffingwell with his sword, injuring the soldier, but not seriously. After that encounter, Reed had Leffingwell arrested on charges of desertion and mutiny. Leffingwell, however, told a very different story at trial. He said that he was following the orders of his commanding officer to go from the front lines to the rear to get more ammunition. While on that mission, Colonel Reed confronted him and ordered him to return to the front lines. Leffingwell said that he informed Reed that he was under orders to obtain more ammunition, but that Reed did not believe him. Reed drew his sword and threatened to kill him unless he immediately returned to the front lines. Fearing for his life, Leffingwell cocked his gun and pointed it at Reed. On September 19th, 3 days after the encounter, a court-martial found Leffingwell guilty and sentenced him to be shot by firing squad. Washington, eager to enforce discipline against deserters, approved the sentence to be carried out on September 22nd. Much of the army, however, was greatly upset at this decision. On the morning of the execution, a firing squad led Leffingwell in front of the assembled army. The firing squad lined up and pointed their guns at the condemned prisoner. At the last minute, a chaplain announced that Washington had reprieved Leffingwell's life and that he was spared. Washington had hoped to make an example by shooting a deserter. Conventional wisdom of the time was that such examples help keep the troops in line during battle. But it seems Washington wisely listened to the grumbling of his soldiers on this day. The army seemed deeply against the execution, and carrying it out might only have the effect of harming morale and increasing the number of desertions. So Washington spared Leffingwell, hoping to avoid this. There is also some evidence that Colonel Reed lobbied Washington for clemency at the last minute, though it's not clear if this was for humanitarian or practical reasons. I should probably also mention that much of what we know of this incident comes from Joseph Plum Martin, a soldier who was fighting with the Continental Army during this time. Martin was a Connecticut soldier who joined the Continental Army during the call for volunteers just before the British invasion of New York. Martin joined the Army as a private, eventually rising to sergeant, and serving through the remainder of the war. He never became an officer, though he appears to have fought honorably and remained with the Army for almost the entire war. There's nothing in particular that stands out about Martin's service that would not apply to thousands of other soldiers during the war. What makes Martin noteworthy and of special interest to history is that after he survived the war, returned home, and grew into old age, Martin wrote an account of his participation in the war. In 1830, he published a book called A Narrative of Some of the Adventures, Dangers, and Sufferings of a Revolutionary Soldier. The book provides a unique perspective into the life of an enlisted man during the war. While there exist many common soldier books from later wars, this is really the only one from the Revolution that covers more than a very short period of time. The book never really got much attention from historians until they rediscovered it in the late 20th century. Because of its unique perspective, focusing on the lives of enlisted men rather than generals, it has become an important source for anyone learning about the Revolution. If you are so inclined, you might want to give it a read. So, next week, while we wait for Hal to give Washington another nudge, we're going to check back in with Generals Carleton and Burgoyne as they finally make their move from Canada into Lake Champlain and their push toward Albany, New York. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. This week, I want to thank my Robert Morris Circle Patreon supporter, Dave Salvatore. Dave runs his own Revolution podcast, Today in American Revolution History. He publishes a short episode, under 5 minutes, almost every day. It's a great way to get your daily fix on the Revolution. You can sign up for email delivery of a text version of his podcast as well. Like me, Dave gives a book recommendation at the end of each episode, so it's another great resource for further reading. Dave also has a new merchandise store if you're jonesing for some Podcast Today t-shirts or mugs. You can learn more by going to his website, amrevtoday.com. This week, New York City burned. About a quarter of the city was destroyed. Since the British had a combined army and navy of over 40,000 in a city that had a pre-war population of only 25,000, finding shelter for all was already going to be difficult without the loss of so many houses. No one ever discovered for sure who started the fire, although I've always thought Billy Joel's denials were a little too extreme. The very likely culprits were patriots who were not acting under any specific orders from the Continental Army, but acted on their own to deny the enemy the use of the city. We also covered today the hanging of Captain Nathan Hale for espionage. American Revolution spying has been of particular interest in recent years, thanks largely to the TV channel AMC, which had a show called Turn, covering the Culper spy ring on Long Island. The Culper ring came after multiple other attempts to gain intelligence from behind British lines in New York failed. Nathan Hale was one of those many failures as the Americans learned the art of espionage through experience. The Culper ring only began in 1778, and that, of course, is something I will cover in more detail when we get to that time period. But for now, poor Captain Hale had to give his one life for his country as a tough lesson for the Americans in how not to conduct espionage. Today's episode also saw the almost execution of a deserter. Such executions were seen as an absolute necessity in European armies to prevent desertion. But in the American volunteer army of the early Revolution, the practice was much more controversial. Later in the war, Washington would go through with many such executions. A great many, though, involved more than just running away. They also involved firing on officers or others trying to prevent desertions. Again, I'll talk more about those in future episodes dealing with the events later in the war. I've already recommended a number of books that talk specifically about New York's role in the Revolution. Rather than throw another one on the pile, I'm going to recommend a more general book this week. I recently finished The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775-1777, by Rick Atkinson. As you might guess from the title, it covers the first few years of the war, from the first battle in April 1775 through the Battle of Princeton, which took place in January 1777. Atkinson promises that this is the first book in a planned trilogy that will cover the entire war. The book was just released a few months ago in May, but has gotten some well-deserved critical acclaim. The book is a little more general than a book that you would find on a specific battle, but at 800 pages gives a pretty good coverage of the first 2 years of the war. Before tackling this project, Atkinson wrote a number of other books, mostly about World War II. but he does seem to know his stuff about the Revolution and has an enjoyable narrative style that reminds me of Shelby Foote's trilogy about the Civil War. If you have not gotten this book already, I recommend it. I look forward to the next two volumes in coming years. The British Are Coming is available everywhere in both paper and electronic formats. For my online recommendation this week, I want to recommend jstor.org. That's jstor.org. The site was built for academic papers and unfortunately has a crazy expensive paywall for standard use by the public. I could go into a lengthy rant about how ridiculous this is that they profit off the free papers that were written by academics who were not compensated for their content, but what's the point? The site does have access to lots of wonderful, well-researched articles on a wide range of both interesting and obscure topics. For documents that are old enough to be in the public domain, you are usually able to get a free downloadable version of the document. For most newer documents, if you sign up for an account, you are allowed to access and read it online, but without being able to download or copy them. It's not ideal, but the detailed content is hard to find anywhere else online. Of course, if you're associated with a university, you may be able to get full access through that. You can also buy an annual subscription, but again, that's crazy expensive. Some libraries may offer better access as well. Despite the annoying paywall, jstor.org is a great resource for lots of detailed information on many different historical topics, as well as a whole bunch of other topics. So, if you're so inclined, please check it out. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.